Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, June 22nd, 2017. Oxfam America says famine has eased in South Sudan, but food insecurity is still rampant.
You know, nobody wants to live in these high IPC levels, IPC 3, 4, 5, the most severe forms of food insecurity, even though they may be short of famine. No one would want to live in those types of circumstances. Even though they may be short, technically, of the famine designation, there's still awful ways to live.
And a South Sudanese basketball player could qualify for NBA tonight.
Today's game, every team needs shooters. I mean, I can shoot with best of them. And I can bring my game. I feel like my game fits the NBA better than college just because there's going to be more space in.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. UN says famine has been eased in parts of South Sudan, but famine-like conditions persist, threatening the lives of tens of thousands in the country, according to Oxfam America. To make matters worse, the onset of rainy season could make it harder for aid agencies to reach more people and save more lives. Ayen Buer has more from Washington.
Famine has been averted in Lira and Mayendit counties, but Oxfam America is not celebrating just yet. The global charity warns that some 45,000 people in Lira and Mayendit counties are still facing famine-like conditions, while half the country, some 6 million people, are severely food insecure. Noah Gottschalk, the senior humanitarian policy advisor for Oxfam America, says although there has been pockets of improvement, the overall picture is bleak.
What we're really seeing across this latest IPC report is a deterioration of the situation around the country and larger numbers of people who are severely food insecure. You know, nobody wants to live in these high IPC levels, IPC 3, 4, 5, the most severe forms of food insecurity, even though they may be short of famine. No one would want to live in those types of circumstances. Even though they may be short, technically, of the famine designation, there's still awful ways to live, and people's lives are threatened.
Gottschalk says the onset of the rainy season will not only make the roads inaccessible and harder for aid workers to reach people in need, but will bring with it waterborne diseases, which only exacerbate desperate conditions. Over 30,000 people in Lair have received the oral cholera vaccine this year. Gottschalk says controlling waterborne illnesses like cholera goes hand in hand with ending food insecurity.
When people have cholera, there's increased diarrhea and vomiting, which means that even if you are able to access food, if you're sick, you're not absorbing the nutrients. And that means a malnourished population that has limited access to clean water is especially vulnerable. It's important to note that it's not just about getting people food. It's about clean water and sanitation and hygiene.
In May, the UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, requested $1.4 billion to assist South Sudan's refugees spread out in six neighboring countries. As of last month, only 18% of that required funding has been committed. Gottschalk says the scale back of famine could slow down the response needed to save lives.
It's a very challenging time, and I think it's important that donors and the aid community and really the international community don't get complacent now just because there's been this small bit of improvement, important though it is for those people affected. Now is not the time to get complacent. We need to be redoubling our efforts and doing a lot more to make sure people get the assistance they need, but more importantly, that this conflict finally comes to an end.
UNHCR says South Sudan has become the world's fastest-growing refugee crisis, as civilians are not only escaping violence in their home country, but are traveling to refugee sites in search of food and basic necessities, which puts more strain on aid groups. Ayen Buer, VOA News, Washington.
Some foreign envoys in South Sudan say they will fund the national dialogue if the government ends the conflict. The National Dialogue Steering Committee said they are facing financial problems to kickstart the national dialogue. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
Diplomats representing the United States, the United Kingdom, Netherlands, China, France, the United Nations, and a number of African countries met in the South Sudanese capital Wednesday to talk face-to-face with the steering committee members about the national dialogue. The steering committee deputy co-chairman Betty Ochan Oguero told the diplomats the committee will send a delegate to South Africa to consult with the rebel leader Riek Machar. She says other opposition politicians and former army commanders outside the country will also be consulted. But Oguero says the steering committee lacks the necessary funding to carry out such activities.
I'm now appealing because those who brokered the peace with us, the Troika, the USAID, all those, suddenly they disappeared out when the peace agreement is being implemented. So I'm appealing that we need you people to come back on board to help us steer the dialogue and move forward and have a better understanding.
And Oguero says steering committee members from Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia and Sudan cannot hold meetings with the rest of the committee in Juba due to a lack of transportation funding. Ethiopia's ambassador to South Sudan, Fisher Sawel Gebre, called on the government and opposition to stop making negative statements about each other to the media.
From the government side, calling the opposition terrorist will not help. And also from the opposition, to call the government genocidal and ethnicity, tribal, and this, it doesn't help. And that is, I think, your objective. Whomever you are meeting, you should emphasize the first thing to dialogue is to call each other properly, respectfully, and focus on the issues.
Abdurahim Khalil, the IGAD representative to South Sudan, says the regional body welcomes and supports the national dialogue as a way to achieve peace in South Sudan. But Khalil says IGAD requires more information from the government about the composition of officials serving on the National Dialogue Steering Committee and the rules governing the panel.
We believe that, as has been stated by you also, this initiative is not a replacement to the peace agreement. It complements and brings the peace efforts forward in order to chart the roadmap for the country for the foreseeable future, hopefully after the achievement of peace and stability in the country.
Joseph Tucker, a democracy and governance officer at the United States Embassy in South Sudan, says the U.S. will support the national dialogue, but the government must end the war now.
Regardless of this process is for fighting to stop immediately. We need a ceasefire. We need movement on that. If anything, for the humanitarian situation in this country to begin recovering. So I just want to underline that focus very much here in this venue and elsewhere, that an end to fighting is very, very much important right here.
Mustafa Sumari is the deputy political assistant of the Secretary General of the United Nations Mission in South Sudan. Sumari says the UN will help fund the dialogue provided the steering committee handles the finances with the transparency and according to international standards of accounting.
In terms of really providing resources to that so-called funding mechanism, being a trust fund or whatever it could be and so on, with the clear understanding that it's going to be managed according to the rules, international rules and so on, so that that also can create this kind of confidence for some of the partners who want to provide the resources that they can come on that.
Steering committee members say they are still in the preparatory phase with three more phases to follow: grassroots, consultations, regional, and finally national conferences. The process is expected to take a year to complete. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
A new study suggests a link between breastfeeding and lower risk of heart disease in older women. If so, the finding adds to the list of health benefits associated with breastfeeding for both baby and mother. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Many doctors recommend that babies be breastfed because of its known health benefits for newborns. Not only does it confer a mother's immune protection to her offspring, experts say breastfeeding protects a newborn from life-threatening infections in countries with poor water quality. Now there's research that indicates breastfeeding may, in the long run, offer health benefits to the mother as well. A Chinese study found that women who breastfed may have lowered their risk of heart disease or stroke by an average of 10% when they became older. Researchers at the Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences, Peking University, and the University of Oxford analyzed data on more than 289,000 women with an average age of 51. They found that those who breastfed had a 9% lower risk of heart disease and an 8% decreased risk of stroke compared to women who had never breastfed. The benefit was even greater for women who nursed their babies for 2 years or more. Their heart disease risk was 18% lower and the risk of stroke 17% less. Cardiologist Nisa Goldberg, who was not involved in the study, suggested the cardiovascular benefits may have to do with the release of oxytocin during breastfeeding.
And oxytocin is a hormone that helps the flexibility of our blood vessels. And flexible blood vessels are resistant to the buildup of plaque or the cholesterol in the walls of the artery.
The findings were published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. Goldberg, medical director for the Joan H. Tisch Center for Women's Health in New York, says it's possible that women who breastfed and saw heart-healthy benefits might have also led a healthier lifestyle compared to other women.
For those women who don't choose to breastfeed, there are other things they can do to prevent heart disease. And that's certainly by exercising, something as simple as taking a walk and eating a healthy diet that's rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and low-fat protein.
Goldberg cautioned the Chinese study was observational, relying on information provided by the mothers many years after they gave birth, so the findings do not prove a cause and effect. Goldberg says now what's needed is a head-to-head comparison of women who breastfeed with a control group of those who don't to see if there are, in fact, long-term heart-healthy benefits. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Still on medical issues, the United Nations reports about 250 million people used drugs in 2015, and of this, about 30 million suffered from drug use disorders, including addiction. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the UN Office on Drugs and Crimes has launched its World Drug Report 2017.
The report says opioids, including heroin, are the most harmful drug type, accounting for 70% of drug-linked health problems worldwide. It says opioids are responsible for many premature drug deaths. Of the 12 million people who inject drugs worldwide, the report finds 1 in 8 or 1.6 million people are living with HIV, and more than half or slightly more than 6 million are living with hepatitis C. Despite the many health problems afflicting drug users, the report by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime finds only 1 in 6 people seeking help have access to drug treatment programs. Deputy Executive Director of UNOD, Aldo Lale Demo, says many countries prefer to deal with drug problems by throwing users in prison. This, he says, exposes them to many infectious diseases.
The standard of care which is provided to those who are incarcerated should be equivalent to the care received by those outside the prison system, with appropriate continuity of care between prison and the wider community. Most importantly, we know that alternatives to incarceration for drug offenses of a minor nature actually help reduce the spread and burden of infectious diseases in prison and ultimately within the wider community.
The report notes amphetamine use also accounts for a large share of the disease burden globally. It finds global opium production increased by one-third in 2016, mainly due to higher opium poppy yields in Afghanistan. The report says the cocaine market has expanded, with the largest number of consumers found in North America and Europe. The report says organized crime groups are reaping huge profits from the multi-billion dollar drug trade, generating between one-fifth and one-third of their revenues from these illicit sales. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, lawmakers call for the formation of a hybrid courts in South Sudan. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today,
what needs to be done to help youth stay in school.
Basic necessities have to be provided, facilities, books, and then encouragement also is highly needed.
Bringing new innovations in studying. We are living in a technological world. We always hear about the e-learning. For them to be easier, maybe they get some problems in terms of going to school, others maybe live far areas, there should be now like e-learning.
To help me stay in school, I think to keep me engaged, because right now we have the education system is more theoretical. If it was a bit more practical and enterprising and a bit more sustainable, then would have more youth stay in school.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Some lawmakers in Imatong State say the government must first establish a hybrid court to try perpetrators of abuses that occurred during the conflict in the country. Dimo Silva Aurelio has details for VOA from Juba.
A technical committee charged with forming the Commission for Truth, Reconciliation and Healing held a workshop in Torit yesterday to educate state officials and gather input on forming the commission. Chapter 5 of the 2015 peace deal requires the parties to form the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to hear victims' complaints, some of which will be forwarded to a hybrid court. But lawmakers and ministers say one cannot talk about truth, reconciliation and healing when the warring parties still can't see eye to eye. Imatong State Information Minister Jacob Atari says the commission should be formed only after the warring parties have sorted out their differences.
And when we talk about reconciliation, national dialogue, we must bring somebody, all people on the board, so that the true reconciliation and national dialoguing will be inclusive. So when we see this, the signatory to this should be included. The national dialogue must start from them. The Dr. Regu Machar, who signed this document, including Paganamu, they have to be absorbed in this national dialogue, so that whenever we are discussing now for this, it will allow really the peace to come to the country.
State MP Severino Mayra accuses officials in the transitional government of national unity of not being honest in implementing the peace agreement. Mayra says the failure to establish cantonment areas and observe the permanent ceasefire so South Sudan is still far off from attaining peace, and a Truth and Reconciliation Commission will have to wait.
It should be something embraced by the government and also those people who are outside, because if we establish it, the other side will say that it is only the government who have done it. What about, you know, violation will continue. And, you know, the conflict, like for instance, when the president came up with a unilateral ceasefire, and it has never taken long, we saw people now got killed along Nimule Road, which means that there is something contradicting that we need to dig deeply into it so that we can able to solve.
But Savio Otor, the Imatong State Physical Infrastructure Minister, says in some countries, commissions for truth, reconciliation and healing have proved effective in restoring peace and stability.
We will still charge the Vez group to pinch straight to the heart of Riyadh, to the heart of Kiev, to the heart of all everybody, to look that the country does not move that way. We are still on the right track. We will form whatever it is there to put the country right.
MP Alphonse Muras Chacha says it will be difficult for the commission to investigate cases in an environment where guns are everywhere.
Those who commit crimes are mostly men with guns. And if we are to start with this commission and put it operational, and those people are still having guns, no peace yet, then we will be putting the life of people again at risk. Because those who will be opening cases and so on will be at risk, even if we say they will be protected.
Imatong State Deputy Governor Margaret Ito insists the hybrid court must be established before the Truth Commission.
It is talking about receiving applications, identifying the perpetrators, recommending guidelines, and recording from the victims. And the end result is not there. There is already a delay. And unless a doctor, again, that result is taken to a doctor and a medicine is prescribed, that person will not get better.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission is supposed to be established to record human rights violations and the abuse of power committed by both state and non-state actors. It is also supposed to develop detailed recommendations for legal and institutional reforms to prevent recurrence of such abuses in the future. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
And now for some exciting sports news for South Sudan. A South Sudanese-born American could be the next NBA basketball star. Tonight, millions of viewers around the world will be watching to see if Peter Jok, the 6 foot and 6 inches tall South Sudanese-American, is chosen for a professional team in the NBA draft. Jok says his journey was not easy. He had to escape a war-torn Sudan, moving from country to country, finally becoming a refugee in America. Sher Deng has more from Washington.
The NBA draft is one of the most anticipated nights in sports worldwide. The night is a combination of years of hard work for about 62 young men hoping to be drafted by one of the 30 NBA teams in America. Among them will be Peter Jok, who weighs 91 kilograms. Jok says his future once looked bleak, but now he's playing competitive basketball and there's hope for a brighter future.
So, I mean, I have a lot of ups and downs, but at the same time, at the end of the day, made me grow into a better man, into a better basketball player. Everything that I've been through, it just gave me more edge and more motivation to go harder. So, man, the process, you know, you just gotta, it's all hard work. There's gonna be a lot of ups and downs, a lot of adversities, but, you know, you just gotta keep faith and then believe in God.
Jok, who's originally from Lake State, says this year has been successful. He was one of the 62 invited players to the NBA Combine in May. NBA Combine is a showcase of college basketball players before the NBA draft. Players are invited to attend. Jok made it to the All-American team and won the 2017 college three-point shooting contest on his 23rd birthday, making him one of the best basketball shooters in America.
Today's game, every team needs shooters. I mean, I can shoot with best of them. And I can bring my game. I feel like my game fits the NBA better than college because it's going to be more spacing and it's going to give me more availability to do more stuff. But the one thing, my strength is shooting, and that's what a lot of NBA teams need right now. And
Jok graduated from the University of Iowa this year, finishing his college career as team captain. He scored more than 1,500 points and more than 400 rebounds. He says he learned his leadership skills and work ethic from his mother, Amelia Ringbull.
Growing up, you know, I was always with my mom, and I'm a real mama's boy. So just when I was younger, I went everywhere with her. No matter where she went, I was always with her. Everything I'm doing is for her.
Many youth in South Sudan and in the diaspora face many challenges and end up on the wrong path. Jok could have easily ended up on the wrong road. He believes the odds were more in his favor. Jok says family and friends are a big part of that.
Moving to Iowa, you know, I've always been surrounded with the right people. And then, I mean, my background coming from where I came from, it's all about hard work. And then if you have the right people around you and have the work, hard work in your system, and I feel like you can go anywhere.
If Jok is picked tonight, he'll be the third South Sudanese in the NBA, together with Luol Deng and Thon Makir. The three South Sudanese will once again put their country on the global sports map. For VOA News, I'm Sher Deng in Washington.
From basketball, we shift our gears to football. Football is one of the most loved sports in South Sudan and Africa in general. In the third part of our series on young South Sudanese refugees, Mungume Debs Rakarinj talks to young people in northern Uganda who still play the game in refugee camps, despite a lack of jerseys and athletic shoes.
And now we have come to the playground where there is a group of young South Sudanese. They are here playing football. So, Kok, you can tell me, basically, you guys come here every evening to play your football?
Yes, we normally come and play here because it is one of our largest time. Whenever we are bored at home after classes, maybe those who are in primary, when they are done with their studies and they have already done their revisions. They need to come here and also play as the leisure time. And when we are done from here, we normally go and have our bathing health now. Then after bathing now, it will be time for supper. After supper, you revise a bit and then you sleep. That is how we are dealing with our evening times. You can see now the ground is very rough. We're not playing boots now, it's very hot.
Yeah. So you guys just play anyhow. You enter in the playground without playing boots, without uniform, and you just enjoy still.
Yes. Because we don't have any alternative. It is because we know that this thing can help us waste our time. We don't have uniforms and playing boots, we just enter. And as long as we know ourselves and our names, it can make us enjoy the game also as well.
Yeah. And also I've seen that there are many guys from different communities. You still come and mingle and play and you get to know each other as well.
Yes, we all these people you are seeing now playing, they all know themselves one by one, and even by names.
And even some locals who want to come and participate, they also play.
Yeah, they can come and play with us. Because we still wanted to create coexistence between the host community and the refugees.
My hosts, Obana Robert, Lul Cook, John Jal, and Abuta Taro, have explained to you how they spend their day here in Agurupi village in Rhino Camp in Arua district, northern Uganda. My name is Mugume Davis Rwakarinj, reporting for Voice of America.
That's my colleague Mungume Davis Rwakarinj speaking with young South Sudanese in a refugee camp in northern Uganda. And that's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Walma by the Abye Jazz Band. We have been listening to Abye Jazz Band with the song Walma. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.